JQ is with us for part three of Poetic Perplexities, Emerging Visions of Global Empire. And JQ, good to have you back. Where are we going today?
Well, we're going to get into Philip Freneau, who, you know, as we've discussed before, is a very perplexing figure in his own right. I know you've commented that he's kind of a Forrest Gump-like figure in some ways, in terms of being one of these people that seems to always be at the in the right place at the right time in terms of major historical events.
Yeah, he's the old composite figure used in movies and such. But this guy, this is for real. And it, what also amazes me is that the traveling that he did, and I mean, I understand that they weren't going around, you know, on camels, but still and all, I mean, he covered a lot of ground, was in a lot of places. And as I said, you know, before, and you're right, had you not come upon this, I mean, this is a character that was kind of pivotal, maybe what you call a second-tier player, maybe. And not a word has been heard of him, as far as I know, from, you know, any history texts I ever encountered or anybody ever brought up.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's made it into literary anthologies, certainly. So I guess, you know, a literature student would probably be a lot more likely to run across him, as I did to a limited extent, you know, as an undergraduate, you know, more likely than a history student might. But I think part of the, he's kind of a mysterious figure, and that's one of the points that the author of this article that I shared with you and that I think you're going to, you know, post with the show notes, Philip Freneau and His Circle, the author of that piece points out that there's mystery. I mean, he left behind quite a substantial body of published work, but the more intimate personal details, a lot is not known, in particular because there was a fire in his family compound or family estate or whatever, and tons apparently of personal papers and manuscripts were lost. So part of the exercise that the author of Freneau and His Circle is doing is kind of trying to fill in some of the blanks and with some speculation based on, you know, the circle of people who he was acquainted with, who he was known to have been friends and acquaintances with, and kind of surmise some of the details about his own life from there. But I wanted to kind of start off with a little bit of that article, actually, because I think it gives a sketch of his activities during the Revolutionary War years, that are a little bit different from other biographical accounts that I've seen elsewhere about him. There's a story about how he was taken prisoner during the war by a British ship or by the British Navy, and one account is that, you know, he was let go on the condition that he would pledge never to take up arms against the British Empire again. So he, you know, he kept up on that pledge, but the idea was that beforehand he was somehow a person of bravery and courage during the Revolutionary War period. But this passage from the beginning of Freneau and His Circle seems to suggest somewhat otherwise.
Do you have any information whether he was a Freemason or not?
Actually, I am concluding that he was, because he wrote a number of Masonic elegies. I think you see some of, you start seeing some of those, I believe, in volume three of the collection. So I think, and the other thing is that, you know, getting back to our old friend Jedediah Morse, who we talked about in the earlier segment, Freneau appears to have spent a lot of time, or he's gone back and forth to the West Indies a lot, and particularly Santo Domingo, which, according to old Jedediah, was one of the hotbeds of this Illuminati activity in the Western Hemisphere here. So,
well, that's, I mean, that's just kind of the general neighborhood where Hamilton came out of, also.
Right, right.
The reason I mentioned the Freemason thing, based on what you had said about his confrontation, if you will, with the British, I don't know that it's a suspicion of mine. I think that it's based in fact that during the Revolutionary War also, if you had two opposite commanders or whatever that were Masons, I'll just say it's suspected that they could get together and say, listen, we don't really have to do this. You know, so you walk on this side of the hedge, we'll walk on this side of the hedge, and, you know, and we don't have to get into it today. So I'm just wondering about that with Furneaux as well. I mean, I think they would honor that. I think that was honored to some extent during the war.
That certainly could explain a lot, and possibly some of his later behavior as well, and clearly some of the poetry that was published in the newspapers that he edited were Masonic elegies upon the deaths of notable Masons, and he seemed to know the form that a work of writing honoring a Mason should take and everything. So again, this idea, and I can't remember where it was I ran across this, sometimes when you immerse yourself in these things it all sort of runs together. But it may have even been in the introduction to this three-volume collection that we're pulling a lot of the poems out of. But it portrayed him as sort of this heroic and courageous sea captain who, again, was taken prisoner. But if you look at the beginning of Furneaux and his circle here, it almost makes it look as if maybe he was a bit more of a fancy boy or something like that, trying to avoid any of the violence that would have come along with active participation in the revolution. So I'll pick up with like the second paragraph of page 37 of Furneaux and his circle. Some of Furneaux's commentators have mistakenly assumed that as a man he was like some of his satiric poems: fierce, bitter, unforgiving, ruthless, and belligerent. Nothing could be further from the truth. By his own confession and from authentic anecdotes, we're obliged to describe him as a physical weakling. At least, in 1775, he fled the oncoming war with England to the West Indies, where he idled pleasantly for nearly 2.5 years. He returned home in 1778, but he hated and feared war, and in 1780 he tried to escape to his beloved West Indies again. His capture and imprisonment aboard a British prison ship nauseated him completely. In no part of his record do we find a suggestion of physical combat or combativeness. His only belligerence, it seemed, appeared in his writings. And so again, that is a bit of a contrast with what you see in some of his Revolutionary War poems, which we're, you know, not going to go into, but he's displays quite a lot of belligerence against the monarchy and, you know, calling King George a reptile and Cornwallis a reptile and so on. But again, apparently he didn't live up to that kind of courage and heroism in his physical life at all. And I just find that interesting that I'm seeing a contrast there between how, you know, two different biographical accounts represented that period of his life. So what I'm going to do is give a quick biographical outline, a partial one that's going to stop at a certain point in his life and that's going to give us an opportunity to get right into one of the poems rather than, which I think is a good thing for the listeners, rather than spending an extended period of time on historical preludes, because there is an ambitious amount of historical background material to cover here. But I'll just start right into the biographical outline without further ado. Furneaux lived from 1752 to 1832. Many literary critics would describe him as the father of American poetry, and in some ways he's viewed as sort of a bridge between, well, a bridge toward, I would say, the more classically oriented and intellectual and formalistic type of poetry that you see in the 18th century to the more, you know, romantic and even gothic sorts of poetry that you'll see later in the 19th century, which would be, you know, the latter folks that I would talk about would be exemplified maybe by, say, Emerson and Poe on this side of the pond, and in particular Wordsworth across the pond. So Furneaux is sort of a bridge figure between two periods, at least according to some of his critics. He was descended from French Huguenots who fled to North America to escape religious persecution after the Edict of Nantes was rescinded. But apparently he departed from his family's Protestant Christian tradition because he's purported to have been a deist and again, apparently was also a Mason, or at least he thought enough of Masonry and Masons to have written those elegies that I mentioned earlier. Now, and this is an interesting, I had noted this down from somewhere, I don't know of my source, but supposedly he was a, at least according to one account, he was a naval officer during the Revolution and was imprisoned for a time by the British for a time. But again, maybe that was a reputation management sort of thing, calling him a naval officer, because other biographical accounts seem to suggest that he was more of a merchant sea captain.
So then
perhaps
he,
even... I'm sorry, what was that?
Oh, no, I was just going to say, he was actually imprisoned twice by the Brits?
I don't think twice, but I said he was imprisoned by the British for a time, but again, yeah, I've already covered that account, but he was
right.
released under the condition that he would never take arms, take up arms again right. against the crown.
So that's
and,
referring to his imprisonment at sea then?
Right,
okay.
exactly.
Okay.
Right. But again, most of what I see, you know, accounted for in the Freneau and his Circle piece, and even alluded to in some of his more, you know, seafaring types of poems, seems to suggest more the life of a merchant sea captain than a military sea captain. He's also been described as the poet of the American Revolution and the anti-federalist poet, which I think one of my main points here is that calling him an anti-federalist is quite dubious in a lot of ways, and we'll get into that as we go along. It seems to me that he didn't become active in opposing the Federalist Party until he joined up with the Democratic Republican Party in the 1790s, and that, of course, was after the Constitution was ratified. But when I ran across the references to Freneau as an anti-federalist poet, I started looking for evidence in his poetry from, you know, 1783 to 1787, which is, you know, the period roughly between, you know, the end of the Revolutionary War and the ratification of the Constitution. I was looking for evidence in his poems that he was railing against the proponents of the central government with the same kind of passion with which he railed against the monarchy and against General Cornwallis in his war poetry. So, you know, what I really didn't find any evidence of that in his poetry of that time period. Now, it's possible that, you know, he had a career as a journalist, which, again, apparently he couldn't make enough money at that to make it his primary vocation, so that's why he had to continue to be a sea captain for most of his life. But, you know, I didn't look at the journalism of the period in which he may well have been actively campaigning against the Constitution. I don't know, but there isn't that kind of evidence in his poetry. And although there is, I ran across one author who speculated that Freneau, interestingly, may have been one of the pseudonymous authors that we see in the Anti-Federalist Papers, but again, I think that's just that, speculation.
Yeah, it doesn't ring too true. Okay.
So, you know, whatever may have happened in his journalistic work, and again, that's, you know, would take some additional research to look into that, but it wasn't directly evident in his poetry that he was opposing the Constitution and the new central government. But one thing I did find is that in kind of an indirect and symbolic sense, we see evidence in a poem called The Departure, which is from 1785, that does suggest that he had reached a state of disappointment with the direction that the new republic was taking. On the surface, you could look at it and say, well, this is just a typical seafarer's poem, and there is a specific occasion of its writing that apparently does mirror an event in his real life, but it, actually this is an excursion that he made many times apparently, but it was on the occasion of one of his departures from Sandy Hook, now that's New Jersey, not Connecticut, of course, on one of his many voyages to the West Indies. But I guess as a Jerseyite yourself, you're probably familiar with the New Jersey Sandy Hook rather than the Connecticut Sandy Hook.
Yeah, and not to go into the whole nine yards, but I'm assuming in that Batman movie, are you familiar with the scene where they're looking at this map?
Yeah.
And Sandy Hook is in there. And so because Gotham always represented New York City, because that's New York City's nickname in a sense.
Right.
Yeah, to see Sandy Hook in there, that's immediately what I thought, was that, I guess it's a, I think it's a national park that's on that peninsula that juts north, yeah. Sure.
Right, and there's a military base there today. Apparently it was a major port of call at one point. And I think it's probably, you know, in retrospect, a lot of the conspiracy theorists who were jumping all over that segment in Batman may have been misunderstanding that this was the New Jersey Sandy Hook rather than the Connecticut Sandy Hook.
But, also, that apparently was a major landmark for ocean-going vessels. The Lusitania, in fact, it's mentioned in there as well. You know, looking for Sandy Hook, because that's when they were going to start to head or tack, you know, north up the Hudson River. And that's what they'd be looking for when they were coming, you know, from the east. So
right.
Sandy Hook has a number of very unfortunate connections.
Yeah, well, also, well, today there's still a military base there, I think, probably not a very well-known one. Or, no, I guess it's a historic base, actually. I guess it's
right.
Not an active one. And then, of course, there's a very special beach in that region as well. Maybe we won't go into that. Do you know what I'm talking about, though?
The only way you would pull up without mentioning, is that a nudist beach or something?
Yeah, it's a what they call a clothing optional beach.
Well, heck, why did I know about that growing up?
Right. You know, I would have thought word might have gone around here and there in New Jersey, but maybe not.
Darn.
but at any rate, my take on this poem, The Departure, is that, you know, there's a lot of basis for looking at it as more than just a captain leaving home and feeling sad about that and feeling a little bit depressed at the change of season. But let's, you know, kind of take a look at the language and let it speak for itself. So it's all right with you. I'll just get right into it.
Sure. Yep.
All right. So it's from 1785, and it begins, "From Hudson's cold, congealing streams, as winter comes, I take my way, where other suns prompt other dreams, and shades less willing to decay beget new raptures in the heart. Bid spleen's dejective crew depart, and wake the sprightly lay. Good-natured Neptune, now so mild, like rage asleep or madness chained, by dreams amused or love beguiled, sleep on till we our port have gained. The gentle breeze that curls the deep shall paint a finer dream of on sleep. Ye nymphs that haunt his grottos low, where sea-green trees on coral grow, no tumults make, yet lest he should wake, and thus the passing shade betray, the sails that o'er his waters stray. Sunk is the sun from yonder hill, the noisy day is past, the breeze decays, and all is still, as all shall be at last. The murmuring on the distant shore, the dying wave is all I hear, the yellow fields now disappear, now no painted butterflies are near, and the laughing folly plagues no more. The woods that deck yon fading waste, that every wanton gale embraced, ere summer yet made haste to fly, how smit with frost the pride of June. How lost to me, how very soon the fairy prospects die, condemned to bend to winter's stroke, low in the dust the embowering oak has bid the fading leaf descend, their short-lived verdure at an end. How desolate the forests seem, beneath whose shade the enamored maid was once so fond to dream. What now is left of all that won? The eye of mirth while summer stayed, the birds that sported in the sun. The sport is past, the song is done, and nature's naked forms declare the rifled groves, The Valley is Bare, persuasively, though silent, tell that at the best they were but dressed, sad mourners for the funeral bell. Now while I spread the venturous sail to catch the breeze from yonder hill, say, what does all this folly mean? Why grieve to pass the watery scene? Is fortitude to heaven confined? No, planted also in the mind, she smooths the ocean when she will. But life is pain, what ills must try, what malice dark and calumny. Indifference with her careless eye, and slander with her tale begun. Bold ignorance with forward air, and cowardice that has no share in honors gained or trophies won. To these succeed, and these are few of nature's dark unseemly crew, unsocial pride and cold disgust, servility that licks the dust, those harpies that disgrace the mind, unknown to haunt the human breast when pleasure her first garden dressed, but vanished in the shade so gay and lost in gloom the summer day that charmed the soul to rest. What season shall restore that scene when all was calm and all serene, and happiness no empty sound, the golden age that pleads so well? The mind that made it shall not tell to those on life's uncertain road, where lost in follies idle round and seeking what shall ne'er be found, we press to one abode. So I had highlighted those last three stanzas, which are, I think, are really key to, or at least hints at what he's really getting at in terms of he's lamenting more than just his departure or the change of the season. I think, you know, he's looking at this brief period of years right after the Revolutionary War, that something's already going wrong, and that the golden age that they had is coming to an end. You know, it's not real specific, but I think he's taking a dark turn in comparison with some of the other poems that he wrote during this period.
You know, and go ahead, I'm sorry, JQ.
Oh, that's okay.
One of the things that struck me is I don't know that this would qualify as a sonnet. I don't think it meets, quote, the structure.
No.
But I was just following you on this, and I mean, the rhyme scheme is very interesting. Just to take a segment, and it seems to go in 10 lines. A, B, A, B, C,
yeah.
C, D, D, E, E. Interesting.
Yeah, well, certainly, at least if it mirrors the rhyming pattern, there's probably is a technical name. I would say a lot of the technical nomenclature of poetry probably isn't one of my stronger points, but that is an intriguing notion, particularly because, you know, a sonnet tends to be more of a love poem, and this is much, you know, clearly a lament and something that's expressing a sense of loss.
This is quite melancholy, wouldn't you say?
Oh, yeah, very much so, and I think there's some key words and phrases here. I mean, calumny, servility, unsocial pride, and then not to mention, almost forgot, there's a lot of pretty heavy-duty classical imagery of very dark things like the harpies and the shades, which you may recall in you know, classic Greek and Roman poetry are the people of the shadow world who have, you know, passed on, and that's their afterlife, to live in this sort of shadow existence. And the funny thing is that I have a recollection of a world literature professor way, way back saying a bit more about the shades. It's not just that they're the shadow people, or the shadow souls of the underworld, but they're the ones who kind of, you know, come and collect your soul when it's time for you to pass on, and then if you're going to Hades or whatever, those are the entities that will kind of, you know, tear you from limb to limb and torture you. But I wasn't, when I researched that again to see if that was indeed an association with the shades, I wasn't able to find anything about that. But anyway, it's, you know, it's dark and heavy-duty classical imagery nonetheless.
It does remind me, though, too, I was going to say that I don't know why this happened, it just sticks in my head, but this is a little reminiscent of Poe. And Poe did write some sonnets that were melancholy. The one I think was one of my favorites was Sonnet to Science. But the sonnet, I think, had to have 13 lines. You know, there were the conventions you had to stick to. But right. So, I mean, a sonnet in itself, I mean, obviously could lend itself to being somewhat melancholy, but this kind of reminds me of it. But what makes this different and I think special is that it doesn't stick to the old ABAB. The rhyme scheme is very, I mean, complex, but it lends mm-hmm. also for a less sing-song poem, which so many of them fall into that kind of category.
Yeah, and in fact, many of his, or some of his, I would say, fall into that category too. And I don't know, I mean, perhaps this is clearly in one particular form that a specialist in poetry could identify just like that. I mean, there's 9 stanzas, I believe. So I don't know, maybe it's an elegy or something like that.
Yeah,
that's an intriguing question.
In 1785, and I don't mean to take you on an ambush on this, but is there anything that he was involved with at that time that stands out to you that might indicate he was in a bit of a more morose or reflective period?
Well, when I looked at the some of the historical timelines, and I believe that this poem was composed in November of 1785, and in that same year, I believe it was in September, there was evidence of, you know, the new republic starting to form. I think we've touched on this a bit before, but starting to reestablish diplomatic relations with the crown. And I believe it was Adams who was Secretary of State at that time, if I'm not mistaken. And in September 1785, Secretary of State made his first visit, his first diplomatic visit to the court of St. James. So certainly, if someone like Freneau, who was so vehemently anti-monarchy, as reflected in his earlier poems, would probably find something like that to be quite disillusioning.
I'm also wondering if he was, you know, I'm just paging through this quickly to try to recall where he was at and what he was doing at that time. I'm wondering if he, it said it was during a period when he was very much at sea. And I'm wondering also if he were married at the time and perhaps lamenting the separation or, you know, something, because, I mean, obviously his life didn't seem to be, you know, really all that difficult in a sense.
Yeah, there were different levels to it. I think even in Freneau and his circle, suggests that he did have some financial struggles. Apparently his family was, you know, quite well-to-do in the earlier generations that had come to North America, but there's an indication right. that, you know, he wasn't able to make enough of a living as a journalist to be able to give up his career at sea, and then he basically resumed or continued that in order to provide for his family. And I think he had, and certainly there were some dark issues here and there. I think his wife came down with consumption, either his wife or a daughter came down with consumption, tuberculosis at one point. So certainly, yeah, it could have been a sad period of life in general, but I think there's evidence of several different layers, personal and political as well.
Well, in this, and I'm not to hammer it, but on page 44, in a Freneau in his circle, this may explain something in that it says, and this refers to his calling as a sea captain. It says, his movements at this time, however, are extremely obscure, and he may have sailed much more widely than we know. It is said that he took up this vocation in real earnest so as to augment his fortune enough to marry Miss Eleanor Forman, daughter of a neighboring family. So in his desire to be together with her, he had to be separated from her to make the money that would eventually allow them to marry. And so now I can understand if this is correct. I mean, if I'm putting it, 2 and 2 together and it comes out 4, that it's this dedication but yet this separation that's working on him at this time.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that's certainly a factor there.
Yeah, so, and again, he starts off, and I mean, he sets the tone right away in the departure with "from Hudson's cold, congealing streams as winter comes." You know, it's like, okay, now all of a sudden, you know, the Hudson isn't this wellspring of hope. Now it's this cold, congealing stream, you know.
Right, yeah, exactly. So, but nevertheless, it's not until the 1790s, really, that we see this evidence of opposition to the new regime showing up. And that's actually after he had aligned himself, you know, this was after the Constitution was ratified and after he had aligned himself with Jefferson's supporters in the Democratic Republican Party.
But what he's what he's lamenting here, though, is now what we know today to be so vitriolic. Isn't he really now involved in partisan politics?
Yeah, absolutely. And he presents himself as an opposition voice after the new system is in place. So I think that makes the notion of opposition, you know, dubious. Yes, he's getting involved in partisan politics and supposedly opposing the original Federalist Party, but again, it's within its context of a new and very powerful regime.
Does he commit himself, though, to Jefferson in the end? Does he not stand with him?
Yeah, it seems that he... I didn't run across anything indicating that he had ever turned against Jefferson. No, but kind of the next excerpt I wanted to go into, and this is from Freneau and his circle, relates the story of how Jefferson and some of his associates, or I should more accurately say, some of Jefferson's associates set him up with a new newspaper that appeared to have the express purpose of being a platform to campaign for the Democratic Republican Party. And that's on page 46 of Freneau and his Circle. And it reads, there is a rather involved story, too long for rehearsal here, about the efforts of Burke, Lee, Madison, and Jefferson to establish Freneau as a Republican editor in Philadelphia. But it can be said that there is no evidence of collusion on Freneau's part, though there does seem to have been some degree of collusion among the others. In any case, by October 1791, he had issued the first copy of the National Gazette and was established as Jefferson's translator, daily meeting the Secretary of State, and that was Jefferson at the time. Frequently receiving from him material in the form of foreign intelligence, copies of the Leyden Gazette, even contributions for his paper from Jefferson's correspondent. Here, too, the poet-editor must have been stimulated editorially by meeting the various callers on diplomatic and state missions. So there's kind of two tiers to this. I mean, he was set up with the financing to run his own newspaper and set up with sort of part-time government sinecure working for Jefferson as a translator.
Yeah,
so,
it seemed, that's why I was wondering, because it almost seemed like it was questioned whether Freneau was really outfitted for the post, and I'm thinking political appointment, you know, so what's the big deal here? And of course, if that came down from Jefferson, that's why I thought that he might have, you know, hitched his wagon to Jefferson. But this might also be a case of, shall we say, changing winds?
Yeah, that's quite possible. At any rate, it is during this period of time that you do see an opposition voice, quote-unquote, showing up in his poetry, but not necessarily the type of opposition that you would expect from someone we would call an anti-federalist, at least not in the context of the anti-federalist papers, because he seems to very quickly latch on to the French Revolution, which is kind of the next really big and ambitious topic we're going to need to get into here, and I think it's just necessary to go into some of that background to be able to understand, put a framework on where Freneau was going. Because again, he very overtly begins to support the French Revolution, and George Washington even spoke out against him, calling him that rascal Freneau, because he was appalled over Freneau's activities of helping to set up Jacobin clubs in the United States. The thing is that if that's an opposition, let me say that one of the definitions I've seen of Jacobinism or the revolutionaries in France in general, in terms of the form of government that they wanted to put in place, is the term I ran across is centralized republic, in which the constituent parts are relatively weak and the federated power is very powerful. So this is almost a greater degree of central authority than arguably than was set up by the Constitution. And certainly as the French Revolution moved on, you really see that it was, that it very much had the characteristics of, you know, the kinds of totalitarian movements and governments that we saw in the 20th century. We get into Goldberg, the excerpt we would look at is called Jacobin Fascism.
Well, it's almost the case of new boss same as the old boss. I mean, the Jacobins were there supposedly to overthrow the monarchy and that kind of despotism, but then do they not tilt also to a certain kind of, not despotism, but fascism, you know, severe control?
Right, and what you see in the contrast with Washington, for example, I think, is that that crew were still thinking of themselves as more of a genteel elite class, aligned more with the monarchical tradition, whereas I think the French Revolution camp was more of a revolt of the middle and lower classes, the common people. But that takes, I'm sorry, what were you saying?
No, I'm thinking about what you're saying and kind of just, yeah, it's almost like the despotism of monarchy over in France gets overthrown by a certain, what would you call it, not a despotism, but kind of a mob control, which you got to wonder if that doesn't devolve into anarchy sooner or later, you know?
It reminds me of so much. I mean, the primary entity that was in power during the peak of the revolution was called the Ministry of Public Safety. And, I mean, you know, duh, what does that remind us of? Very much.
Okay.
I mean, you know, Homeland Security, and this was the first example that you see of, you know, well, an early example anyway in more modern history of terror and the constant state of crisis being used as a means of maintaining total control over the population. And then I just think there's a huge irony, you know, looking at the timeline that I pulled of the French Revolution, is that, you know, they started by overthrowing a king, and at the end they end up with an emperor. I mean,
exactly.
You know, what is how much of a revolution is that? Although, you know, if we go through this timeline, I think you'll see, and probably you have this in mind as well, another important factor in the overarching powers that may have been involved.
Mm-hmm. Well, I tell you, it was a wild time on the European continent at the close of the American Revolution and into probably the 1830s. And all kinds of treaties and all kinds of, I guess, alliances. Yeah, it was wild. I mean, it was a lot of changing seats at that time in Europe that we don't really not too much aware about.
And really, to try to summarize the French Revolution is an ambitious topic, because obviously, you know, multi-volume works have been written about it. One of them was by Thomas Carlyle, who is probably an interesting figure to look at, given that he, you know, started in his youth as being almost sort of a proto-romantic New Age type of person, and then ended up being a very, very much of a quote-unquote conservative Tory. So getting his take on the French Revolution might be an interesting thing to do. I haven't read that work at all, but...
What's surprising about this whole deal, and I've thought about this as an example at least three times in European history, but Napoleon was raised up for a reason. I would call him a scourger. He was at the behest of something, some dark powers or whatever, however you want to say it. And when that job was done, and I won't define that now, I think you're going to wind up doing that. I'm going to listen to you as you go through the timeline of the revolution. But I find it so strange, and they did the same thing to Hitler later on. Why in the world would you go and try to invade Russia in the fall?
Yeah, it's insane.
Yeah, because they dashed Napoleon, and they finished them off, obviously. Wellington finished them off, but why would you go do that? It was as if your job is done, and we can't have a 700-pound gorilla on the continent, so you're going down. And the same thing happened with Hitler. You can't be that stupid. I find it interesting, and that would indicate to me that Napoleon was used for political reasons to smack around certain nations. But that's all I'll say right now. And I'm gonna turn it to you because I'd like to see if what I'm thinking is also what you're going to apprise us about.
Well, yeah, and I think and this timeline I pulled actually comes from a university professor at the University of Indiana, and you know I haven't read any of her essays or anything, but some of the issues that she pulls for the timeline seem to take things in some intriguing directions, and I think as we get towards the end, some points that are made just before, just after Napoleon takes over, or take things in a direction that you'll probably find very interesting. But I don't know. I mean, having not been at all a scholar or even as anything as humble as an undergraduate student of the French Revolution, I'm sure there's a lot of gaps here that more of an expert can fill in, but we'll do our best with what we have here.
Okay.
So, starting out in 1774, Louis the 16th, great grandson of Louis the 14th, the Sun King who built Versailles, becomes King of France. In 1770, he was married to Marie Antoinette. Okay, and then, after only 4 years in power, what does he do? July 1778, allied with the American colonies, France declares war on Britain. And that's pretty huge itself. I mean, I think we all get the junior high history that the French were involved in, you know, supporting the American Revolutionary cause, but apparently this, you know, this was a major, major effort. I mean, it's not just a matter of intervening here by, you know, sending Lafayette over to help out or whatever, but they're fighting a war, a complete war across the pond, which almost puts Britain, I guess, in the point that the level of resources, I mean, it sounds like a brilliant strategy if France really does want to affect the course of events in North America, because they've got British so tied up across the pond that the resources they're going to be able to deploy in the colonies are probably quite limited.
Well, I think that's one of the reasons why, you know, I have a different take, and maybe you do too, on the revolution and just exactly who won what. But it did seem that Britain's attitude, and it supposedly is factually represented in certain discussions in Parliament, that's like, look, what are we doing fighting this thing? Let's just get this, like, let's get the business in order, take care of that. Let's get them out of there, and we got other intrigues here on our continent. And I think that's pretty accurate.
So, in September 1783, we have the Peace of Versailles between France, the American colonies, and Britain. And you just a quick comment here is that you notice Treaty of Paris, Peace of Versailles. It seems like everything's being brokered by France here. So who's really defining the terms? Who's the real winner here? I mean, maybe it's really France that's in control more than a lot of people realize. But the consequences of this whole effort on France were apparently deep, and I don't know, you can get into whether any of this might have been speculated about, whether any of this might have been by design behind the scenes. I don't know, but I really hadn't been aware that the cost to France of helping the North American colonists' cause was extreme and pretty much brought them to the point of bankruptcy. So the next date here, August 1786, Controller General Cologne, faced with the impending state bankruptcy, suggests reforms to Louis the 16th. Tax reductions, free grain trade, unitary land tax. Normally, any such reform would have to be enregistered, accepted by the Parliament of Paris, sovereign law court. But the Parliament has often rejected reform attempts in the name of protecting historic liberties. Rather than presenting Cologne's reforms to Parliament, then the monarchy convokes an assembly of notables. Now, and here's an interesting point, I think, behind the Revolution. Apparently, the French at some point had their own version of the Magna Carta, which set up an allegedly constitutional monarchy. And I guess it was a three-tier parliamentary system consisting, if I'm correct, of the first, second, and third estates, which would roughly correspond, you know, dividing the classes into three tiers rather than the two-tier system of the House of Commons and the House of Lords, or that we have across the pond, or the House and the Senate that we have here. But apparently for extended periods, the king just pretty much ignored that, and he had complete and unmitigated veto power. So apparently during this period of time, that parliamentary system was not fully operational, so that the king had a tremendous amount of power to circumvent any of the parliamentary processes.
Yeah, and yet that also was one of the points of opposition to the Constitution. And that is, I mean, any constitution that allows the president to write executive orders or to become potentially dictatorial under war powers, well, then, you know, why do you bother with the branches then, you know? Because it does really,
right.
I mean, I think Patrick Henry even said that. Although he did sign on, he just said after, out of one side of his mouth, you know, today we tilted toward monarchy.
Right, and that's why I think Patrick Henry himself and other anti-federalist writers were, you know, referring to the president as an elected monarch. And really, I think, you know, there's so much talk about the elegance of the checks and balances, but, I mean, the big detail that people miss is that all those checks and balances are still within the context of this centralized behemoth of the system, which people even back then during the time of the Anti-Federalist Papers were saying was the most, would become the most powerful central government ever to have existed on the face of the earth. So what was lost, sure, there's checks and balances built in between the executive and the legislative and the judiciary, but those are all part of one federal government. So there's a sufficiency of checks and balances of the states on that federal system. I mean, I guess, you know, technically there's a capability of the states convening and calling another constitutional convention or something like that, but I'm certainly not going to hold my breath waiting for that to happen.
No. And again, what do we have here, though? I mean, it's I think, one of the problems that people often, always overlook, and that is the appearances. Just as you said, you know, it's interesting because balance is not gotten through two entities. Balance is gotten through three entities. I think that's the reason why you have the three branches and such. Also, if you remember, and I hope this isn't too banal an example, but with Orwell talking about the three power spheres, even as we look today, we think about three power spheres, Russia, China, and ourselves. However, as you said, if they're all playing on the same side, you're dealing with the appearance of some kind of checks and balance operation when, in fact, you do not have one. Take that.
Yeah, exactly.
Don't get me started.
Yeah. Right.
All right.
So in August 1788, we see de facto state bankruptcy. And 1789, let me back up here. Okay, January 1789, Sieyès, I don't know who that is, publishes What is the Third Estate, which again is part of that three-tier parliamentary system. Electioneering raises questions about how voting will proceed in the estates general, by head or by estate. So on May 5th, 1789, we have the opening of the estates general, voting to be by order, i.e. one vote for the first estate, one vote for the second, and one vote for the third, rather than by person. So apparently what that means is, apparently these houses within their parliament, if you will, were of different sizes. And in fact, it is. The latter is favored by the third estate, as it is, which is, I guess, the most closest to the common people. The latter is favored by the third estate, as it is twice as big as either the first or second. In voting by orders, each order meets separately to decide its vote. So apparently what happens is, instead of having sort of a proportional representation, and I guess under the auspices of the king, it was determined that all of the votes in each house would be rolled up into just one vote, so that essentially, you know, the voice of the commoners would be subsumed or canceled out by the first or the second. At least that's the best interpretation I can come up with at this point of this complex parliamentary system and how it seems to have been being circumvented. So, May 6, 1789, delegates from the Third Estate refused to meet as a separate group and call themselves the Commons. So I'll skip ahead a little bit and move to a point that I find rather interesting, even though I don't fully understand all the details, but it's intriguing. 11 July 1789, Louis, the king, dismisses his chief minister, the popular Swiss banker, Necker, and replaces him with the reactionary Breteuil. So apparently that really inflamed the hoi polloi, if you will. Word of Necker's being fired reaches Paris, prompting protests in many different contexts. Speeches in the gardens of the Palais Royal, closing of the stock exchange, looting, etc. And then 14 July 1789, a famous incident, a Paris crowd storms the Bastille prison looking for arms with which to defend itself against the army rumoredly massed around the city. Troops refused to fire on the crowd. So a firing of a banker touches all this off. Mm-hmm. That's intriguing to me, and I wonder why. I mean, maybe you know something about that.
No, I don't. It just seems to me that in this case, for whatever reason, I mean, again, this, the professor may not be necessarily subjected. I mean, the insights are probably sound, but if the Swiss banker was popular, then I would think that would mean that the people were more comfortable with Necker than what Louis was doing. It looked like Louis was getting ready to clean everything out. I mean, there's just so many elements in this. And I've not studied it, and whenever I did, it was so long ago, to appreciate all that was going on and what the real story was. But I think, you know, this seems to be an excess of Louis that touched things off. But what's really interesting is what that statement was attached to July 14th. The people are going to defend themselves against the army rumoredly massed around the city. So do we have a false flag op here? Was there really an army massed out there, or was that just, you know, the op to get people to come out in revolt?
Or it backfired because there was a real army, but it backfired because the troops had shifted their loyalty away from the king in this situation. I think to speculate on what could have been going on with the bankers here is that, yeah, the popular Swiss banker, that suggests to me that this was someone who was an exponent of economic policies that were more in the interests of the, presumably, I guess, the bourgeois, the middle classes, and the working classes as well, so they would have the money to buy their bread and not just eat cake as Marie Antoinette wanted them to. So this may have been a situation of, you know, inflating the money supply and making sure there was plenty of money in circulation to fuel the economy. And I would imagine that the king, as the instigator of these military adventures against Britain and to assist the American colonies, would have been the one who would be on the hook for this debt, whoever he owed it to. And that's a missing question here. Who did France owe this money to?
All right.
Oh, do you have an insight there?
No, something seems to be missing, and we both know it, and we can do our homework later on and maybe come back out with this. But, you know, I got to tell you what I thought about right from the get-go, and that was a banker, a European banker, and I'm thinking Calvi and the Vatican, you know, back in the 70s, and now I'm thinking Necker. Could Louis have offended the Vatican? I don't know. And then, of course, you know, you had that crazy time when they split the papacy between Rome and Avignon. You know what I mean?
Right.
So I don't know. And I'm being completely innocent about this, but something seems to be missing here. And again, you talk about dark powers, but I'm going to have to take a look at Necker and see what, you know, exactly what he was about. I mean, Wikipedia will give you a bit of a thumbnail.
Right.
But I'm looking at, you know, why was he at least revered in what he did? Was he an honest person, and was getting rid of him an affront to anybody else besides, well, of course, not the Louis? But Louis, this is the Sun King, is it?
No, he's the grandson of the Sun King, actually.
It was the Sun King who had the split personality, wasn't it? Who had two separate councils? Do you remember this?
I'm sorry, say that again.
No, it's just that, again, I think back to some of the really zany stuff that has happened amongst the royals. And I was a Louis the Sun King, I think, that had a split personality. He had two councils, one for each of his personalities. And
that's a story that I've entirely... I must have missed that.
Oh, no?
In,
yeah, that's
world
for sure.
History or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah,
interesting.
Well, we got about 2 minutes left. Is there a point at which... you want to wrap things up or do a summation?
Well, yeah, I'll give a little bit of the teaser, I guess, of what's to come. But I think it's also interesting as an aside that they described the replacement for Necker as a reactionary. So that's almost sounds like a Paul Volcker figure who's coming in and raising interest rates and limiting the money supply so that... to kind of starve out the people or whatever, to divert wealth back into the hands of the central authorities or directly to the king so that the debt can be paid off. And then, skipping ahead almost to the end, I mean, with the reference to the Vatican, I think we're going to arrive at that point again, because there's certainly at least a coinciding of events of the decisive installation of Napoleon and the restoration of the ties to the Vatican.
And we'll pick it up with part four.
Absolutely.
Shadows in the sound, seeming to be the chimes of freedom flashing, flashing for the warriors whose strength is not to fight, flashing for the refugees on the unarmed road of flight, and for each and every